Wednesday, March 4th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Judd Slivka. On our program this week, Hillary Clinton's use of a private email address while Secretary of State raises all kinds of questions about transparency, security, and the law. New accusations about Bill O'Reilly's tales that he had told during his days as a field reporter, and step aside Kim Kardashian, it seems a swatch of fabric really did break the internet. Black or blue, white or gold, it meant a whole lot of green for BuzzFeed. There's a whole lot that we'll hopefully get to as well, but we're going to start this half hour with some of the ethical issues that journalists found themselves facing last Thursday following the apparent suicide of Missouri State Auditor Tom Schweik. He died in his Clayton home last Thursday of what police are calling a self-inflicted gunshot wound, moments after leaving this voicemail for St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial page editor Tony Messenger.
Tony, it's a Tom Schweik calling on this. You can have a reporter here at my house at 2:30. I'm willing to speak to both Post-Dispatch and to the AP only about this matter. I would give a brief prepared statement, which we would videotape, and then can answer questions from your reporter. This is only for you two, and I hope you'll not make it known that I'm doing this. But give me a call and let me know if you can have somebody here at 2:30. To me, this is more of a religion story than a politics story, but it's your choice on who the reporter is. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Messenger explained in a note to readers that the two men had had a few conversations in the days prior, talking about rumors that Schweik believed state GOP chair John Hancock was spreading about his faith. I don't so much want to talk about what happened in the past week, but the two dilemmas that Schweik's suicide presented for the journalists covering it. Let's start with that decision that Tony Messenger made to share that voicemail, to publish it, to hand it out to other media, and to release the details of these conversations the two men had had previously.
Is the greatest conceit that we have in the media that we're not part of the story? Tony Messenger was part of that story, and if it were something else, if he had called someone else, left another voicemail on a non-media machine, then the Post-Dispatch would be doggedly looking to obtain that voicemail. I think that we should applaud Tony for being transparent.
No, I agree. And he said, at least in his writing about it, that he thought Schweik would have wanted it that way for him to disclose the information. Whether or not that's a good enough excuse, I don't know. But I did think it provided some nuance and some understanding of the story that we wouldn't have had otherwise, since Tony was such a key to it.
Talk for a minute about that idea. There's kind of an expectation out there that journalists protect sources, that oftentimes we see different reporters, we've even talked about it with folks at the New York Times, James Risen right now, fighting to keep their sources and their information private, even being willing to go to prison for that. It all changes when that source isn't alive anymore.
I think that that's absolutely true. But I also think that this is different than protecting a source who's provided you information where there may be some sort of whopper in that information, some sort of bomb that's going to be dropped, like the Pentagon Papers or, you know, Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. I think that here what you're seeing is there's no obligation because Mr. Schweik has passed, but also because there's not really any confidential information here. There's no need to protect that source at this point.
And Schweik is the story, so it seems to me that that's relevant information that should be shared.
Now, I know one of the questions that was posed to me by non-journalists was this confusion that came from the fact the story was even covered, because they don't often see or hear the covering of suicides. And there's some nuance here that would need to be explained. Let's share that idea with why this is a story when so many other suicides aren't.
Normally, we won't report a suicide unless certain very specific conditions are met. Mm-hmm. Is the person a public figure?
In this case, yes.
Or they thrust themselves into the public limelight by their behavior. They maybe committed suicide in a public space. They caused some kind of public, you know, reaction or caused a problem for the public in doing so. And, you know, this story obviously met those conditions. But we typically wouldn't report a suicide otherwise because of the worries about copycats and encouraging other people to do the same thing to get their 15 minutes of fame.
I think that Mike brings up great points. The fact that he was a public figure is the dominant part of why we do this. I don't think if it were anyone else in a less public role, we would be covering this.
I have to say, though, I think there's one other sort of, I don't know if it rises to the level of ethics, but certainly professional practice when it came to the coverage of this story. And that was either in the news coverage or especially in the editorial columns, this sort of attempt by some folks to try to simplify the cause for this behavior. I mean, he committed suicide. He committed it after talking about the fact that he felt that an opponent was starting a whisper campaign that he was Jewish, or that there was a really nasty attack ad that was on the radio about him. And then a lot of media sort of just said, well, one thing caused the other. If you look at the Post-Dispatch, they read an editorial that said the auditor might have pulled the trigger, but the bullies who were campaigning against him held the gun to his head. Suicide just isn't that simple. I mean, I really thought it would be useful for news organizations to do some stories about just what we do know and don't know about what causes suicide. I mean, I looked up, for example, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and what they say about it. And they said some suicides appear to be impulsive or spur of the moment or may follow a very upsetting event like this one. Yeah. But while we all go through painful experiences, suicide is not a normal response, and only a small percentage of people react by taking their lives. Suicide almost always results from the pain and desperation of mental illness. So just to be fair, whether or not we want to decry how awful politics has become, to try to draw a straight line cause and effect between one and the other, I think the media shouldn't do that.
I would agree. I think we do have a media culture, though, that at this point looks to simplify complex fractions down to their very most simple. And
to do that as quickly as possible to then wrap up, move on, as opposed to provide depth and context in reporting.
Right. Okay. And, you know, I do think there is something to be said for how the public responds, you know, favorably or not to some of the attack ads and the whisper campaigns and all this kind of stuff. One of the ads that ran was this basically a parody of House of Cards, the Netflix series where the congressman who commits murder, really commits murder, becomes a president of the United States. And they used
Not just once.
They used his voice or a parody of his voice to make fun of Schweik and how he'd be run over by the Democratic candidate. Well, you know, a lot of people actually like that show. We're waiting for House of Cards to come out here this past week because, admit it or not, we kind of believe that that's the way politics really works, and that's how effective politics gets done, by the people who are ruthless enough to do whatever it takes. The public has some responsibility here.
I think that, yes, because we don't stand up and argue. But when former Senator Danforth, who was the auditor's mentor, stands up and says, essentially, he may have pulled the trigger, but you all got him to that point, and then we reject that notion because we said, well, we didn't do that. Who are we to be blamed for it?
Well, there's a difference between saying one thing caused another. Suicide is very complicated, but there's nothing wrong with saying this is an example of just how low our politics has become. As long as we can separate those two arguments, I think that latter argument is one we should make as often as we can.
Okay. Let's go ahead and transition into another story, also sort of in that political realm, one that I didn't even realize was possible. During her time as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton never once used a government-issued email address. Every single email she sent during that time was done through a private email account. It's kind of strange to that point, even where former White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, he told Matt Lauer that cabinet members are usually told they must preserve all correspondence.
There are lots of briefings that you have when you go into the White House about preserving any email that you have, making sure that it's part of your official account. I think it's something that they're going to have to explain in good measure today and probably figure out how to get a lot of those emails or as many as they can back into the
archive. It provides a layup, doesn't it, Robert, for her critics who say this is all about a lack of transparency as she prepares for a run in 2016, that you can't go back and look at those emails?
I think there's no doubt. I think this is another one of those things that the Clinton campaign, such as it is going to have to explain. And I think it's much easier for critics to explain why they don't exist than it might be for her to explain why she used a private email.
So I'm kind of tempted to follow up on that basketball analogy and that layup and say there's some kind of a slam dunk that something here doesn't feel right to me, at least. This is pretty concerning.
And I have to say, I wish we could step back just a moment and not cast this as a typical, the right says this, the left says that. There are a lot of people who are interested in openness and transparency and freedom of information who are also worried about what Hillary Clinton
did. Well, from
where
I'm sitting, that is the bigger issue than the political part of this.
Absolutely. And whether
this is our chief diplomat who's not keeping records.
Right. I don't know if she violated the law or not.
We're not
but
lawyers.
She certainly could be argued she violated the spirit of the law. And when you look at it, the New York Times, which broke this story in the first place, had a really interesting piece today following on to that, which basically said that she was able to thwart NFOIC requests, Freedom of Information requests, because the government agencies responding to those requests saying we don't have that information because it was stored on a private server and not backed up by the government.
Well, and of course, that's why everything is supposed to be on a
government server.
Both for archival purposes and not. So I think that the one of the big issues here, this does play into that opposition narrative of look how arrogant the Clintons are. For people who have had as many perception management issues as the Clintons, how could this one be another? Did you not think that you were going to get caught?
Yeah, and I have to say, I think that it's obvious to me that it seems obvious to anyone who looks at it that the purpose of doing this, there's only one logical purpose for doing all of your emails from a private account so that you can control the release of that information if someone ever asks for it. Now, it's true the government backed up any emails she might have sent to her colleagues who were using federal government email accounts. But if she was sending emails to private persons or other, you know, foreign leaders or diplomats, it wouldn't have been backed up. And we have to take her word and her staff's word when they're asked to turn over these records that they've turned it all over.
Well, and that becomes sort of the crux of this debate is how do we know who to trust? How can we trust you if we don't have full access?
Mm-hmm. Well, quickly, I want to follow up on last week's discussion about Bill O'Reilly and claims that he had made up details of stories he covered while at CBS News. Since that time, we've seen his ratings continue to rise and new allegations waged against him. What developments have come in the last week or so?
Well, so now there are four separate, you know, allegations that he exaggerated or lied. One, that he was in the war zone in Argentina when he was actually in Buenos Aires, not in the Falkland Islands. Once, that rioters in L.A. in the early 90s were, you know, throwing bricks and stones at him. Once, that he was actually physically present at the suicide of a Confederate of Lee Harvey Oswald. And then I think the fourth one was...
Nuns.
Oh, the nuns in El Salvador. Haven't you ever seen the nuns being shot? Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, those are all out there. Where did those four come from? Two of them came from Media Matters, which has had a years-long campaign to try to knock down Fox News and Bill O'Reilly. And the other two came from two very left-leaning news organizations, okay? So that's the argument that Fox and O'Reilly are using to get out from under these accusations, that it's all a liberal campaign against him. And you know what? For his audience, it's working.
You know, I think that if we can look back at the history of fabulists, if this is indeed fabulism, it never stops at one and never starts at one either. And I think we can also look back in 2011, the National Park Service refused to stock his book on Lincoln's assassination at the Forge Theater bookstore because of inaccuracies in it. So I don't think this is anything new. I just think we're seeing more and more come to the surface.
Well, and you see a lot of people trying to compare this to Brian Williams, and there are some valid comparisons and some that are less valid. I mean, the thing that stands out as different to me, at least, is where did the initial allegations come from? In the Brian Williams case, for good or for ill, they came from the veterans, the soldiers who were with him during that trip in Iraq, and then they complained, and Stars and Stripes, the military paper, picked it up, and then all the mainstream media picked it up and ran with the story. These stories about Bill O'Reilly, for better or worse, basically started with left-leaning news organizations or or fact-checking groups who are digging up dirt deliberately trying to taint O'Reilly. That doesn't mean that what they found is any less true than what was said about Brian Williams, but the source does determine how the public perceives it.
Question the source. For months, we've been talking about those gruesome videos showing ISIS beheadings. And one of the things that we haven't talked about so much in those discussions was who was behind the mask. Well, we know that now. We know that that masked man at the center of those videos, Jihadi John, as he came to be known, is a Kuwaiti-born British citizen named Mohammed Emwazi. The Washington Post and BBC both claim to have reported the story first, the Beeb being the first to publish the name, the Washington Post being the first to really have the story. Forget who had it first. Let's talk about the story itself. Who is this guy and how these two organizations began to piece it together?
Well, so first of all, I mean, the story is that he was a, I believe, Kuwaiti-born British citizen, well-to-do son of some folks in Great Britain, who, for whatever reason, became radicalized. Some of the stories from the BBC and other media tended to point to the fact that he was harassed by MI5, the British Intelligence Service, as one possible explanation for why he became radicalized. There are other thoughts as well. And at some point or another, he was trying to move back to Kuwait, where he had a fiance, apparently, and the British government kept him from doing that. Somehow he escaped. He ended up eventually, I think he was in Somalia at one point, and then he ended up in Syria. And how the newspaper, how the Washington Post actually put together the pieces, to me, is also kind of interesting.
I mean, I think that it comes down to really good reporting and talking to sources and working and working and working and working until you find what you need and being persistent. And I think that that is at the heart of what they did.
There's a great piece on our Links blog that started to put – there was a behind the scenes on it that puts together some of those pieces, looking at the voice recognition, a lot of the reporting being done through voice recognition on those videos.
I think this is interesting, too, because the Washington Post reporter, at least, who talked a little bit about this whole process, said how frustrated he was that U.S. intelligence knew the identity long ago. British intelligence,
as did the British intelligence as well.
Long ago. And the sort of excuse that, well, we were looking to protect the other hostages by whether or not that was a legitimate argument then certainly didn't make any difference. And so I don't think the Post felt any problem at all about releasing the name at this stage.
Well, maybe the timing was totally intentional, maybe not, but Saturday night, there was one of those classic Saturday Night Live commercial parodies, this time poking fun at the Army's recruiting ad showing a nervous parent saying goodbye to their eager new soldier. Let's take a listen to it.
You know, you could stay home, do another year of high school if you want.
Very funny, Dad.
Well, I'll see you at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I'll see you. Hey, Dad.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You got it, kiddo. Looks like your ride's here. You be careful, okay?
Dad, it's just ISIS.
That was Dakota Johnson, who was the guest star of Saturday Night Live this week. A lot of viewers felt that that sketch crossed the line. Your gut reactions?
No. I think that it was played for that moment where the pickup truck comes up. I think that if it's satire, if we're going to call it satire, satire comes from the extremes. I think that it was that. I didn't feel offended by it.
Can I say that? Yes to both things. I mean, I think you should allow humor to be able to say some things that we can't say in polite society or in typical news coverage or whatever. We have to protect the right for comedians to be able to do that kind of thing. Was I also offended by it? I laughed, but was I offended by it? Yeah, when I think about him, you know, so, well, see you back at Thanksgiving, when we have young men and women going over there to do that, and they may never come back. And so I can see why parents, especially, would have been offended by that, even those who really like Saturday Night Live.
Well, and especially, I think part that also hit a nerve with folks was how close this also was to the death and people still mourning Kayla Mueller and the Arizona woman who was beheaded by ISIS. And just this idea that maybe it was too soon. Same time, we have a whole lot of folks out there that are saying satire and it's the only way to defeat an extremist ideology like this.
Well, I think that it helps and that decision of too soon or when is a very, very delicate place to be. And I think that we saw it after 9/11. I think we see it time after time after time. And Saturday Night Live deals with that to some extent because they're on so often and they often spin off of topical events.
I mean, it does show strength in a way that we can laugh about things like that, just as Saturday Night Live went on right after 9/11, and they were able to laugh about, not about 9/11, but they were still able to have some laughter and humor.
And by Saturday night.
So I buy that. I don't dismiss that at all. But sometimes, you know, you can have the same, it can have more than one impact.
Okay, net neutrality. We have been talking about that for what seems like forever, too, about how we as Americans access the internet. The Federal Communication Commission voted last week in favor of net neutrality to make sure that every consumer and all content on the internet is treated equally online. Companies can't slow down speeds or limit access to their competitors' sites. It's not often that we see big business come out on the losing end of a vote like this.
Probably the last time was the last time that we had major telecommunications reform. And really, that's what this was done, was the FCC decision to regulate this as a telecommunications industry instead of bits and pieces of little things. I think there was a lot of individual power behind this, but I think there was also a lot of corporate power behind this. Certainly Netflix comes to mind, though they just cut a deal in Australia and New Zealand to do exactly what they were lobbying against here in terms of net neutrality.
Yeah, and I would agree. There were, yes, big business was on the losing end. Some big business was on the losing end, and some big business was definitely on the winning end. I mean, if you look at the content providers like HBO or the broadcast networks or Netflix, if you look at some of the folks in startups or even the bigger, you know, tech companies in Silicon Valley, they see this as a win. Now, whether consumers who are portrayed as the big winners in all of this are really going to win, I have to say I am so skeptical, because if rates actually go down or service measurably improves as a result of this, I will be shocked.
I don't think that it's going to. One of the things I do every morning when I wake up is check my daily Mediacom usage from the day before. I don't think I'm going to end up not having to do that anymore or pay Mediacom less for internet access at home, am I?
I will say, though, I found it interesting. The New York Times ran a story where they said, is there anyone who's had experience with net neutrality, any countries? And there's two countries in the world that have adopted this, Chile and the Netherlands. And so they did a story where they looked at the Netherlands, where the telecommunications companies were making the same dire predictions. Innovation is going to die and dry up, and it's going to be all terrible. Well, it hasn't been the case in the Netherlands. Speeds are fast. Service is good. Innovation continues to grow. It's really more about the inherent level of competition and the opportunity to make a profit than it is about whether the government's going to regulate it or not.
I think one thing that we know reliably is that businesses, large corporations, will figure out ways to make money.
Yep.
So this next topic is one that people around the journalism school know is probably the last thing that I want to talk about. And interestingly enough, it happened on the same day as that net neutrality vote. Yes, it's the dress. You probably know the one by now. It's the one that some people saw as white and gold and others saw as blue and black. People argued over it. They fought over it, for heaven's sake. What color is the dress? Who cares? But it's an internet meme that jumped from the front pages of Reddit to the mainstream media in just a matter of hours. BuzzFeed claims it had more than 670,000 users on that story page in one given time. Talk about winning the viral race on that.
Someday, 2150, a historian is going to look back and go, that's the moment that we lost. If it's the
historian, Kim Kardashian, is already wondering how was it she didn't figure out how to do that.
If only
she
had
lost
that dress.
To a dress
that she didn't have on or not, right? That you didn't own.
But let's talk about how BuzzFeed won out on this one. Let's take it back to BuzzFeed.
I think we can get too serious about some of these things.
Yeah.
I mean, can you understand why an audience would find this story to be a fun one to debate? I mean, beheadings, suicides, fights over immigration, blah, 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 blah. Here is a story where we can have an argument, and yet we're not going to be lasting enemies.
Photo.
We can even after we do these viral stories, look at all of the news organizations that came on board to tell about the science of visual perception. And those stories were kind of fun. BuzzFeed does it better than anybody. And that's the one thing that I think maybe I would take seriously out of this discussion. So BuzzFeed is able to be BuzzFeed, and they're becoming more and more serious by hiring all kinds of serious journalists to do serious stories. Can legacy media be serious mainstream news organizations and be BuzzFeed at the same time? I don't know.
That's the thing I'm always talking with folks about, and what makes BuzzFeed great is we're seeing BuzzFeed begin to expand, is that they are finding ways to capitalize off of the dress, or take the quiz to figure out which character of The Office you are, or 18 ways to make a brownie in a coffee cup. But they're using that to be able to pay for some of that in-depth investigative reporting, pulling some of the best reporters out there in to join their staff.
Well, that's an innovative model that they're using. But I think if we go back to the specific piece, how many produced pieces of "we hope it's going to be viral" don't go viral for BuzzFeed in this way? So you hit that strike of that oil well, and it goes on. But how many dry holes have they hit in between? And in order for this to be a truly viable underwriting method for serious journalism, they're going to have to figure out how to get more strikes and less dry holes.
I think it also says something about, how hard it is to become the brand that people associate with a certain type of product or service, and how difficult it is to crack that monopoly when somebody has it. I mean, Apple didn't invent the smartphone, but boy, when they became the brand, huge companies like Microsoft could not get themselves into that.
Even going back further, the MP3 player. There were MP3 players all over place before the iPod.
And it's the same, maybe the same thing with BuzzFeed and this kind of news. I mean, you might be the New York Times or CNN or other folks who are trying to mimic BuzzFeed in terms of this viral storytelling. Maybe there's only room for a couple of brands, and one of them being first is BuzzFeed.
No. I'd agree. It's a crowded space, but how many people really do it well?
Well, we're going to have to see where that goes and keep watching with that. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. We're just about out of time for this week. You can read more about the topics that we talked about on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and to Maya Jackson for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hannah Smith is our associate producer. We'd like to thank her for all of the hard work she has had and done for us in these last 8 weeks. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.